Hello, everybody. This is Bill Knauer, and you're listening to Author, where we talk about writing and life, because what it takes to write the book you want to write is also what it takes to lead the life you want to lead. Author to Author is brought to you by Author Magazine, the premier free writing magazine on the internet, featuring articles on writing and the writing life, as well as video and audio interviews with best-selling and award-winning authors across the genres. You can find Author Magazine at authormagazine.org. And we are funded by the Great Pacific Northwest Writers Association, supporting writers from pen to publication since 1955. You can learn more about the PNWA at pnwa.org. They've got a great conference. Happens every year, every summer, here in the Seattle area. It's going to be down in what we call SeaTac, halfway between Seattle and Tacoma. And it's going to be a good one. I'll be teaching a master class in memoir writing on Thursday. It's going to be late July, 28th, 29th, 30th, something like that, the end of July. I'll be teaching a master class. The best-selling author, Bob Degoni, will be teaching a master class. The wonderful Donald Moss will be doing something on Sunday at the end of the conference. Is writing is your breakout novel. Oh, it's going to be a good conference. So check it out at pnwa.org. I will be Friday the 29th, which is in a few weeks, up in Bellingham at the Chanticleer Writers Conference, teaching fearless writing. Got to be fearless, people. Fearless writing and marketing for authors who hate to market, which is, I think, most of you. But not our author, not our guest today. I don't think our guest today is hates to market. I'm just guessing that. But if you do, come join me at Chanticleer Writers Conference up in Bellingham, Washington, April 29th, 30th, and 31st. I'll be there. Okay, Kara Bradley. Wow, am I glad to get Kara on. Kara is a yoga teacher, mental strength coach, former pro skater for Team Rollerblade, and entrepreneur who has devoted more than three decades to movement disciplines and personal transformation. She is the founder of Verge Yoga in Philadelphia and the co-founder of a non-profit mindfulness through movement, providing full-year mindfulness programs to more than a dozen schools in urban Philadelphia. Wonderful. She's the host of a podcast, Real Women, Courageous Wisdom. But we're also going to be talking about a new project of hers. It's going to be out in exactly a week, I think, though it's available on Amazon now for pre-sale. On the Verge, Wake Up, Show Up, and Shine, out from New World Library. Talk about timely. Talk about timely, because on the cover of this book is an endorsement from none other than Jay Wright, head coach of the Villanova University men's basketball team, who just last night, April 4th, 2016, became national champions with a dramatic three-point buzzer beater to beat the North Carolina Tar Heels. And he says, a must-read for anyone who is passionate about peak performance at home, at work, at play. Wow. Did she know that was going to happen? No, she didn't. But he did it anyway. Kara, lucky you. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Bill. You're giving me the chills just hearing you speak those words. National champions. Fantastic.
Isn't that amazing? Isn't that amazing? And so what did you – and so – all right. Well, before we get to that, I could just talk about that, I think. But before we get to that, The Verge. On The Verge – I think it's a great concept where The Verge came from. For our listeners, describe what The Verge is.
Well, great. And thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be
here. Oh, you're
welcome. I love talking about this topic. I've been teaching about it forever. And so for me to be able to put it into words and to then be able to share my passion for being on The Verge is a great honor. The Verge came about, the word The Verge came about from a experience my husband had when he spent a few weeks down in the Amazon. And when he was in the Amazon with some indigenous tribes down there, they continued to come across these places where the two rivers would meet. And there's this little plot of land right where two rivers or tributaries would come together. And it was on that specific, these specific plots of land that the indigenous people revered these places to be sacred. And when we started to dig in a little bit more as to why these places were sacred, it's because on the verge, on these places where two rivers meet, is where animal life and wildlife thrive. It's where they are the most diverse. And so when he came home from the Amazon and told me about this, I've been a human potential junkie my entire life. I thought, oh, my gosh, if there's actually a verge out there, I want to live on it.
Right, right. And so you have really spent, and it's interesting, you began the book with a story about sort of how this started for you. And it's something I connected to because I ran track and it was kind of a big part of my teenage life for sure. About an experience you had. It sounds like you were running the 800. Is that true?
Yes.
Okay. So you were running the 800 in college and it was the last competitive race you were to run. Is this true?
Yes, it is. Yes.
Okay. And what happened? Tell the listeners what happened that day.
So what happened on that day, I was formerly a pretty mediocre runner. I trained hard, not too hard. I fooled around. My coach would say, get up, you're going to race in a half an hour, go warm up. And I'd kind of fool around with my friends a little bit. So I ended up just being kind of middle of the pack. Well, this was my last race. I was actually transferring schools, and I knew it was going to be my last college race. What I did, my 19-year-old self did, which was unusual, was I went off by myself. And I went off by myself. I took a slow warm-up jog, and I started to contemplate my 19 years of life and my track career, and I thought to myself, why don't you just go out on top. Why don't you get your personal best? At least do that for yourself. And so during this warm-up jog, what started to happen was I said to myself over and over, personal best, personal best, personal best. And this went on for a good 10 minutes. So that by the time I stepped up to the starting line, I was calm, settled, and focused.
Yeah.
In a way that I'd never experienced before.
Yeah, and the starting line, I should say, for our listeners who have never put their toes or their fingers like I had to do when I was a sprinter on the starting line, that is a strange sort of surreal place to be. And you have to learn how to be there. And it took me years. So there you were at the starting line in a calm place for the first time in your sort of track career.
Exactly, because I usually felt like I was going to throw up. I
right.
usually
yes.
felt, right? You know
yes.
what's
oh, yeah.
coming.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, oh.
what am I doing here? I could be doing a lot of other things besides this. Okay, so there you are, but you're calm now.
So I'm calm and steady, and so the gun goes off, and I take off, and I don't really remember much about the first lap. But what happened during the second lap that I do remember is that I passed our very top mid-distance runner. And I remember having a thought, and that was, wow, she must be having a really bad day.
Oh, you humble child, you.
And so I continued, and I came in third place, and my teammates jumped on me, and I had no idea what happened until I looked up at the clock, and I saw that I had shaved 6 seconds. And as you know, 6 seconds in the 800 is ridiculous.
That's a lot. 6 seconds. That's like Bob Beamon's long jump. Wow, okay, so you really carved it up.
So I really, really carved it up. And so in my first reaction was, I did it, personal best. But I'll tell you, within a split second, this wave came over me and I said, are you kidding me?
Yeah. Yeah, what could I have been doing?
My whole life.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting, isn't it? It's interesting.
Yeah.
I remember one of my favorite events was the 45-meter high hurdles. And it wasn't until the state championships of my senior year in high school that I understood how to start. And it was all mental. I flashed on that as soon as I read that story, because I learned to think as I got down into my blocks, you're a bullet coming out of a gun. And I would think, explode, explode, explode. And what it did is it gave me something to do with my mind, because the 45s were over in 6.5 seconds. It was one boom. But I would normally get down there and not know what to do with my mind. And it was really the first time and it sounds like it's the same is true for you, that you understood the link between the mind and the body and just your overall experience and the role the mind plays in your life experience.
Yes. Yes, exactly. And so I spent, you know, I was 19, 20 at the time, and I spent the next 20 years saying what happened during that race. I took it apart. I thought about all the different aspects of pre-race, during the race, and I started to look at what happened and how can I do it again. I knew in that moment I wanted to live in that state. I wanted to know about it. I wanted to learn how to do it in every aspect of my life. It was that powerful.
Wow. But it's such a great story because, you know, you could have easily just discounted it and just thought, wow, I really ran fast that day. Okay, well, let's go get a beer. You know, you didn't have to have that. You didn't have to have that perception of it, but you decided that your life in a way could be lived that way, perhaps.
That's right. And so there were some there were some qualities that I know now looking back that seemed very, very ordinary. Like to me, it really wasn't, you could say it was a peak performance, but there was something very ordinary about what I had experienced that kept me very hungry. I knew I wasn't that far away from it. And so I kept looking in different corners and with different disciplines and movement disciplines and mental disciplines, read books, tried bungee jumping, I walked on coals, I did all these different things to see if I could find that way in again.
Right. But one of the things you did to get in, it sounds like, was and it's sort of hard to explain, but again, it's something that I relate to because I remember when I was 19 or 18, I was at college and I thought, and I'd had some kind of experiences that kind of broke open my reality a little bit. And I remember going around thinking, I want to know the difference between simply living and actually being alive. That was my differentiation between simply going through my life and actually being alive. And it sounds like you had a similar experience where you differentiated between being present and living and trying to sort of achieve. Is that a fair differentiation?
Oh my gosh, absolutely. I mean, being fully alive is actually what my whole book is about. This has been my quest as a teacher, is I use different disciplines to help people feel more alive, awake and fully alive. I feel like so many of us, you know, we do go through the motions. We have these glimpses all day long that we just don't recognize. This is it, actually. It's when I'm driving home from work and I stop at the red light and I look up and there's this incredible sunset and I pause or I gasp. That's life. You know, the commute is just what happens in between those moments.
Yeah, that's right. And as I hear you describe this, it reminds me of one of my favorite quotes from a book I like to read that says, "A miracle is a shift in perception." That what you're asking your readers and it sounds like your students is to, because it's a strange thing, you're teaching them, but really aren't you helping them remember something? Something
definitely.
That they are already.
That's right. In fact, I say in the book, there is no better version of yourself. There's no seeking and striving and achieving. It's actually just shifting from doing to being or from thinking to experiencing.
Right. Yes.
And in that shift, we actually arrive. We arrive right in the center of our lives.
But it's an important thing, and I hope my listeners heard that. She said the difference between, now it's between thinking and being, right? Thinking and being.
The way I generally say it is, it's a shift from doing
and experiencing.
To being, and then thinking to experiencing.
Right. Doing to being and from thinking to experiencing. And because experiencing is really a receptive state of mind, whereas thinking is more of a active, constructive frame of mind. Is that accurate?
Yes. Yes, and the way that I put it, I put it in very, very simple terms. Most of us are living from our busy mind.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean that we're always thinking about a thousand things, but most of the time we're seeing life through the lens of our busy mind, which includes stories, judgments, comparisons, predictions, all of the things that hold our mind constantly. This is the way that when we look out the window, if we're consumed with work, we're seeing the tree through the lens of all of the stuff that we have to do. But
yeah.
when we're able to settle and shift beyond the notion of thinking, beyond all of the constructs of our mind, we actually then just directly experience looking at a tree. And what happens when we're able to settle our mind and settle our nervous system and actually just look at the tree, or actually just sip the coffee, or just smell the roses, everything becomes more vivid. Our senses feel more vivid, what I call high definition. All
yeah.
of a sudden, the lights are brighter. This is being fully alive.
Yeah. We don't understand the degree to which our thinking filters our experience, but it's dramatic, really, isn't it?
Yes. Yes.
Go ahead.
I was going to say it actually distorts. It distorts
yeah.
the way we perceive life. So going back to what you said about shifting perspective, you know, looking at life through the lens of all of the stuff that's constantly flowing through our mind distorts. So shifting, settling and shifting, it allows us to shift our perception of the tree, of the coffee, of the rose.
That's right. And I had the experience once of walking down a street, and I thought, we think we're walking down the same street, but everyone's walking down their own street. All the people I pass, because everyone is seeing the street through their thinking, if they're thinking, and most of us are thinking. We think we're seeing the same thing, but I just don't. I think even looking in the mirror, you know, it's like you're not looking in the mirror, you're looking at yourself looking in the mirror, which is, you're looking at a reflection of yourself looking at yourself. Do you know what I mean? So even
That's
then,
right.
It's often not a pure experience of that image you see.
Right. And this is a really big concept, and it's a really challenging concept
yeah.
for us to get our hands around, because we're kind of involved in it. It's kind of like trying to, notice what it feels like to feel wet when you're actually submerged in the water. We're just
right.
submerged, right?
But
what I'm offering, and it's just based on my own experience, and it's based on the experiences that students of mine have told me, is that when we can recognize these glimpses of being alive, that's when that shift of perception starts to begin happening for us, and it starts to happen more and more. When you start to allow yourself to pause, to smell the coffee and taste it, but you know, instead of just drinking it while you're writing an email, it's very, very subtle, but it really is very huge, and it can really change everything for us.
Well, it doesn't. And to some degree, you're talking about something that one of my favorite authors, also from who started at New World Library, talks about, Eckhart Tolle. His in was what he refers to as the present moment. He's not the only one now, but really, you're describing being present in the moment, not the future, not the past, but what's happening right now without judgment on it.
Yes.
What would it be like without judgment on the moment?
That's right. What does that feel like? I mean, it's hard for
yeah.
us to really understand. We can't figure it out. We actually just have to directly experience it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Eckhart Tolle was a huge influence in my life. Huge.
Yeah. Well, he says it beautifully. But so do you. And I got to say, you talked about something I really appreciate, which is asking the reader, your students, to really trust their own experience, the power of your experience. Can you talk about that a little bit? Because you can say a lot, one can teach and teach, but in the end, experience is probably our greatest teacher. as it was for you.
Yes. Yes. And in fact, my first chapter is called Let Me Do. And I
tell
a story, a little bit of a history about myself being a very stubborn, independent, young, little Italian girl from Brooklyn who just needed to do everything myself.
Right.
And what I recognized is that I need to experience things. I don't want to be told that this flower is yellow. I want to see the flower that's yellow. I want to taste. I want to smell and feel. And so what happens is, what happened for me is that as a teacher, and I've been teaching movement disciplines for 35 years, my entire life almost, I have recognized that when I allow students to experience their body, to experience a moment, when I let them go, right now I've been teaching yoga for 20 years, when I can shut up as a teacher and give the students space, they find out much more about themselves and life than I could ever tell them.
Experience is a great teacher. I mean, and as a teacher, you can, I do teaching, I teach also. And one of the things I feel like I could do is offer a story about experiences the student might have that hopefully frames that experience in a positive way. But in the end, it's their experience that will confirm the story, so to speak. So you can talk about being present, but it's when they have that experience of drinking the coffee without thinking about other things, but just drinking the coffee, they'll probably turn to you and say, "Oh, Kara, I get it. I tasted the coffee. It was great. I want to do that again." The experience really teaches them.
I actually break down experience into three types of experience, which for me has been really helpful. So we have experiences all the time. We have secondhand experiences. This is the easiest one to understand. So a secondhand experience is me telling you, Bill, that if my yoga class today was so great, I felt fantastic, my mind was settled, and it just changed my whole day. Well, that's my telling you about my experience. It's your secondhand experience. You could never experience what I experienced in yoga because you weren't there. Right, so that's really easy to understand. Then there are muted experiences. And this is what really the point is in a lot of the book, is saying much of our lives, because of our mental busyness and our emotional disturbances, we spend most of our lives having muted experiences of life. So, for instance, you get into the car after work and you drive home. And you drive up into your driveway, and all of a sudden you think, how did I just get here?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yeah, the muted experience is you're not experiencing life, you're just experiencing your thinking. You're really in a movie that you're watching.
Right.
Which is okay sometimes if you're somewhere you don't want to be, I guess. But life can be more interesting. And then there's the true experience.
Right. There's the true, direct, full sensory experience where your mind has settled enough that you are fully present in the now, in the words of Eckhart Tolle. You are right here, right now, like I was in my race. My mind had settled because I had gone off and I took some time and I said personal best, which kind of settled me. And all of a sudden I was in this direct, full sensory experience. And what happens is that everything gets turned on. Your energy is more accessible. Everything becomes vivid. Your senses are lit up. And this is the sense of being awake and fully alive. This is being on the verge, right there in those tributary, right on that plot of land where life thrives.
Right. Yeah. You know, I think sometimes the reason I was growing up, I was both an athlete and also a writer and kind of an artist. So I crossed a lot of disciplines, and a lot of times I had friends who did one thing but never the other. And I know that there was a kind of a bias against the athlete as not being smart, you know, the kind of cliche about the jock or the athlete. And I think part of it has to do with the fact that one of the beauties of athletics, of using the body, is you can't think. That to do it well, you turn off the mind. That's how you thrive. I remember even being in the middle of running an out pattern for my football team, and I had the thought, you think you stink. you know, that if I think about it, it's over. And there's a great pleasure in not thinking and just being present in your body. And yet it can seem anti-intellectual or whatever, but in fact, it's a high state of aliveness.
That's right. Yes. And some call it the flow state or being in the zone.
Yeah.
Yes.
And I would imagine, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I would imagine that some of the students you get are people who live in their head a lot of the time and have to be taught to come out of that little terrarium and be a part of the other world, their physical world.
Yeah, and you know, we all live in our head, and we're just conditioned. We're conditioned in our society, and it's no fault of ours. So, you know, I always tell people, don't feel bad about thinking. Thinking is actually a really good thing. You know, we have great inventions and creativity because we are able to think. And this goes back to Eckhart Tolle, one line I absolutely love in The Power of Now, and that is he says that your mind is an instrument. The problem, and I'm, you know, misquoting him here, but giving you the idea, is that the problem for most of us is that the instrument has taken us over.
Yeah.
That we don't, we no longer have control of the instrument, and we don't realize that we're not just this thinking instrument. We actually have the capacity to live from our other senses and our other intelligences, like our physical intelligence, like the athlete.
Yeah. And I would say that one of the things I love about writing is that at its best, it is a kind of experiential thinking because it is such a receptive, I actually describe it as the flow, where you enter a kind of meditative, you're not thinking about life, but you're receiving inspiration about it. At its best, it becomes close to what I would go through at the high flow state in my athletic career.
Yes.
I don't know if you've gone through that in writing The Verge or not.
Well, I'd love to say I was in the flow state when I wrote my book, but as you know, quite a challenge. I mean, boy, the highs and the lows and the meeting yourself straight in the mirror and the head on the desk. I mean, I went through the whole gamut of emotions while writing. Yes.
Did you have much of a relationship to writing before this book, or was it something you did just sort of whenever you had to?
I've been writing a blog for about 5 years, and but really a very much an amateur blogger, writing for my students locally.
Yeah.
So stepping into this arena was a huge challenge for me. I sought out a lot of support, and I'm so glad I did. And what I've being on the other side of it now, for the most part, with the book just about to launch, I think I can finally say, I'm a writer. I'm a writer.
Oh, say it. Say it, Kara. My God. You are. I give you permission, and all I do is talk to writers day in and day out.
Yes.
So you get it. Well, that is a perfect place to launch into my final question for you, Kara, before I set you free. And what I'd like you to do is finish this sentence for me. If writing has taught me anything, it's taught me what?
To not hold back.
To not hold. Did you hold back before this? You don't seem like a hold backer.
I didn't hold back as a I don't think I held back as a teacher, as a communicator. Okay. I'm a skilled verbal communicator at this point, so many years in. But I did hold back as a writer. Once pen went to paper, I edited before it even came out of my mind.
Oh, yeah. Very common. Yeah. Very common. But you learned to kind of cut loose a little bit by the end of it?
Yes, I did.
That's good. That's the key. That's the key, boy. I'll tell you, I teach writers, and the big reason I teach them is it's easy to write in your journal, you know, because you know no one else is going to read it. But as soon as you are aware that another human being is going to read it and possibly judge it, it changes the relationship, I think, for almost everybody instantly. And I would think that's more the issue even than just putting words to page, because I bet if you had a journal, you could write quite quickly.
Sure. Yes.
You know, but that's great. So you were taught not to hold. Good for you. Don't hold back. Don't do it. All right. So On the Verge, Wake Up, Show Up, and Shine is going to be on news or books in bookstores in a week. So that'll What is the exact date, Kara?
April 12th is the official pub date.
It is exactly a week. Okay, good. But they can order it now on Amazon or where have you. Best of luck, Kara. It's an awesome book.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Oh, you're welcome. Okay, good luck.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Don't hold back, people. Don't hold back. You're only going to be denying yourself the pleasure of it. Okay, well, listen, I'm taking next week off, but the week after that, on the 19th, I'm going to be talking to the wonderful Abigail Thomas, best-selling author of A Three-Dog Life, about her newest memoir, What Comes Next and How to Like It. Until then, don't hold back. Go out and do something you love, people. Be in the present moment.